Identity Crisis, Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. There's a dispute in France over full-body swimsuits for Muslim women, and it's causing a debate about what it means to be French.
I want my country to be the country of liberty, equality, fraternity, not the country that sends cops to ask women to undress because they have a different religious belief.
Plus, a journalist comes under attack at a Black Lives Matter protest.
But what ended up saving me, I think, is another group of people came over and stopped the attackers and told them that I was Chinese or Asian and that I wasn't white.
And in Thailand, we send our intrepid reporter into the bathroom.
And I'm going to try and get total strangers to open up about their toilet preferences.
And they do. Today on the World. Glad you could be here today. Let's start the show with a piece of swimwear. A piece of swimwear that has sparked so much debate. The burkini. Here's how Ahida Zanetti, the person who coined the term, describes how it all came about.
It was very difficult for me to say, well, it's a swimsuit made for Muslim women. And they just couldn't understand, like, what the hell are you bringing out? And when I said it was a two-piece, they thought, oh, my God, Ahida, what are you doing? So I quickly had to somehow think of a name to actually call it without actually referring it to Islam or Muslim.
And so the burkini was born, head-to-toe swimwear with a nylon veil or hijab. Zanetti says she designed the burkini because of the restrictions on Muslim women in France.
I remember France actually banning the hijab in public schools and universities. And that's what motivated me more to make sure I introduced something that was not going to identify a Muslim woman.
Well, as we know, that's not exactly what happened. At least 11 French towns and cities have decided to ban the burkini on their beaches. But as Rim Sarah Alouan, a student in Toulouse, told me, it's not yet become a law.
I have seen that mistake almost everywhere. It is not a law. It is a local decision taken by local authorities, municipalities. And obviously, they should be taken in conformity of the law, and that's why they are challenged. But it's not a national ban, even if some politicians are calling for it.
Right. For example, the city of Nice, they do have a ban, and now we know through these photos that have gone viral online about the woman who was taken off the beach there. Take Paris, though, for example. Mayor Anne Hidalgo called the ban in some of these cities hysteria and said the French should instead focus on improving social cohesion. It sounds like politicians in France are divided on this.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And especially within the right wing, mostly all agree on that, the far right wing, obviously. But regarding the left wing is divided and strongly divided. Prime Minister supported the bans. But right before Anne Hidalgo, the Minister of Education, Najat Vallaud-Belkacem, denounced this ban for the same reasons, as in it's a huge problem, it goes against women's rights, etc. And Prime Minister Manuel Valls called her out. So the left wing is very, very divided.
I mean, the argument goes in France that wearing the burkini, wearing any clothing with religious connotations, is not French. It doesn't conform with the French principle of assimilation, right? And yet, you, Rim Sarah, you are French. How do you even counter that argument?
We are in a democracy. We are supposed to be in a liberal democracy, and nothing in the law on separation of church and state, the principle of laïcité, secularism, says that we shall not express our religious affiliation in the public space. It is wrong. Actually, laïcité applies for civil servants, not for the people. Laïcité, neutrality, should guarantee, state neutrality should guarantee freedom of religion, you know. I saw a nun on a bike yesterday, and I loved her for that. I loved the fact she was enough confident to go out on her bike, dressed with her veil and robe without having the cops on her back. So not being able to express your faith or your ideas, etc., is actually anathema to democracy.
I actually misspoke. I said the French principle of assimilation, yet I really meant secularism. But it raises a question. What do you see as a difference between assimilation and secularism?
It's a very interesting question. And actually, this slip of the tongue is not really one, because France is a country that do not legally recognize minority because they fear it. So you have the principle of assimilation, The thing is, there is this idea, and it comes from history, that you cannot recognize differences. And if you are different, you cannot assimilate. And regarding Muslims, especially if you take the colonial time in Algeria, then the post-colonial era, etc., Muslims are considered as a group who cannot assimilate, who cannot be integrated. So literally what we are doing right now with the Burkini ban, but not only, because it has been going on for years, we are telling them, you Muslims, by the way, they are French. They're French citizens. You are expressing a religion we consider that is not compatible with, I quote, the values of the Republic, whatever it is. So we are going to make sure to make you disappear from the public space.
Rim Sara, you're a Muslim woman living in France. How does this ban in some of these cities affect you personally?
I'm deeply worried for the future of my country. You know, I was born there. I was raised there. I love my country. You know, the Minister of Interior asked French Muslim to say loud and clear that we love the value of the Republic. I love the values of the Republic. I hope he can hear me. but this anti-Muslim sentiment, which has been institutionalized for years, and I mean, the Burkini ban has shown that very well. I'm worried of the future of democracy. You know, we are the country of human rights, and yet we are blatantly violating them. What have we become? I want my country to be the country of liberty, equality, fraternity, not the country that send cops to ask women to undress because they have a different religious belief.
You know, we also heard recently that in Canada, the Royal Mounted Police have just approved hijab for Muslim women in their ranks. Are you also having conversations about how France compares to other countries that are more and less tolerant of all these things?
Actually, that's the topic of my PhD thesis. I'm actually doing a legal comparison on the protection of religious freedom in Canada and France. And yes, absolutely. I think we should learn from other advanced democracies. Recently, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reaffirmed the right for everybody to make their own choice and supported religious freedom, etc. I think at some point we shall be more open-minded, you know. The France of the colonial time is not the France of today. We are a multicultural country, and we need to learn from others and from models that work, like Canada, which is for me, I mean, they have issues, right? But for me, it's one of the models that has succeeded the most in terms of to include minorities within the Canadian landscape.
Rim Sara Alouane, PhD candidate at the University of Toulouse in France. Thank you very much for your time and your thoughts today.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, cartoonists from across the globe have been weighing in on France's Burkini ban, and we've been collecting some of their best cartoons online. Just head on over to Facebook and look for Global Political Satire. The ideals embodied in the French motto, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, also figure into this next story. It takes place here in the U.S., and it involves Aaron Mack, a student at Yale. He recently wrote a piece for Politico titled, "You're Asian, Right? Why Are You Even Here?" So, Aaron, that title alludes to something you heard 2 weeks ago in Milwaukee. You were interning at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and sent out to cover a protest after the fatal shooting of Sylville Smith by a police officer. Tell us what happened that night.
I was sent to go check out the shooting of a black man by a police officer. And when I went to the scene, I saw a lot of people from the neighborhood, which was predominantly African-American, gather and were outraged at what had happened. And there was a line of policemen there who were processing the scene. And a lot of people there were yelling at them. And some of them were pushing at the police. And a lot of people noticed me in the crowd because virtually everyone there was African-American. So I was questioned for why I was there as an Asian American.
Was this a spontaneous protest, by the way, or was it organized around Black Lives Matter?
It was actually sent through Facebook. So a lot of people there were saying Black Lives Matter. I don't know if it was part of any of the official branches, but yeah, it was billed as a Black Lives Matter protest, though I don't know if it was actually connected to the larger national movement.
So what kind of things were you hearing as an Asian American in this protest?
A lot of people asked me why I was there. They asked me if I was Asian, what interest I had in being there. Some of it was hostile. Some of it was positive. Like a kid came up to me and asked me how to speak Mandarin. So I gave her some words. So yeah, it was an interesting mix of positive and negative reactions to me being there.
And then things got kind of really hostile, didn't they?
Eventually, the crowd's tactics did become a bit more violent. They started smashing cars and shooting. And at one point, I was with a colleague who had come on later. He's a white man. And he had been shooting pictures and made some of the people there angry, both because, yeah, he was taking photos and because he was white. So he got chased down the street and I went to go try to help him. So I chased after him. And when I yelled at him to get out of the area and tried to help him, people associated me with this person. So they started chasing me and eventually they caught up to me and tackled me and beat me up on the ground for a little while. But what ended up saving me, I think, is another group of people came over and stopped the attackers and told them that I was Chinese or Asian and that I wasn't white. And the attackers let up and they left and people who intervened got me to safety. So it was interesting that I was also spared because of my race.
When you told your family about what happened, how did they react?
Yeah, a lot of my family is kind of skeptical of the journalism path I'm taking. So yeah, first off, they said that I should probably look into law school instead of reporting. But I had had a lot of debates with them in the past about issues of systemic racism, and they ended up being actually a lot more open-minded about what had happened than I thought they would be. They didn't take this as representative of the Black Lives Matter movement. They didn't take this as a representation of African Americans in general. They kind of saw this as an isolated incident that obviously is unacceptable, but it is grounded in some very real issues that people face in America.
Especially after your experience, I'm curious to know where you fall. I mean, Black Lives Matter, they've got some legitimate grievances about continued prejudice and violence at the hands of police. But it also sounds from your experience at that protest as if you saw a complex, prejudicial side of some of those protesters.
I would say that the protesters that attacked us were definitely out of line, but there were a lot of protesters there who helped us, who helped my friend too, even though he was white. So I guess my overall image from that experience was that there are a lot more people who want to help and who think of it as an inclusive movement for everyone. And there are some people who are using tactics that are unacceptable, but overall it's a very positive thing that I saw.
Are you seeing efforts generally to increase solidarity among Asian Americans for African Americans?
There's this really great movement, I think, right now called Letters for Black Lives, which is a bunch of letters kind of written by Asians who grew up in America to their first generation families and friends. And I think what's so great about it is that it really takes time to try to understand where their families are coming from in their skepticism. But then it kind of elegantly pivots into, you know, why it's so much more difficult for African Americans in this country right now than for Asian Americans, even though we do still face obstacles.
Another thing, Aaron, there's been a lot of discussion among journalists about how and who should be covering protests such as the Black Lives Matter protests. As a reporter, how do you feel after your experience? Will it change the way you approach your job?
I definitely think I need to be more conscious about my race and what my role is as a reporter. It's not something that I had thought about a lot before going into these situations. I guess I think being really friendly and kind of trying to make connections with people at these rallies is going to be very important to, you know, get trust from people who might be skeptical of why I'm there.
Aaron Mack is an undergraduate at Yale University. He wrote about his experience covering a Black Lives Matter protest in Milwaukee for Politico. Aaron, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
The World's Other Hood podcast recently explored the relationship between Black Lives Matter and other minorities. You'll want to check that out. You can find Other Hood on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, toilet talk in Thailand here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
North Korea is in a good mood these days. The nation is celebrating its first successful test of a submarine-launched missile. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, says that the U.S. mainland is now within striking range of his nuclear weapons. That kind of sounds like a threat. Joel Witt is a former U.S. nuclear negotiator with North Korea. Joel, should we be concerned?
Well, I think the answer is yes and no. No, because despite the success, we're not within striking range of their nuclear weapons. But yes, because this is just one more step in terms of steady progress North Korea is making, building nuclear weapons and building missiles to deliver them.
So are you concerned about what next? If this was successful, then what next?
Yeah, I'm concerned. And I think it should be an ongoing concern for everyone, because North Korea has a range of programs that it's looking to develop. And one of the things that's of the biggest concern is that for the past few years, North Korea has displayed an intercontinental ballistic missile in its military parades that really hasn't been tested yet. And if they get that thing working, then it will be able to reach the United States. And that is, of course, serious concern for all of us.
But seriously, North Korea, I mean, can it really have these aggressive ambitions?
It's not that they're going to, once they get it, they're going to attack the United States. But I think once they have these weapons, it certainly reinforces their efforts to, first of all, ensure that their country survives, but secondly, to threaten others in order to secure their own objectives. So it's much more nuanced. It's not as if they're going to attack us right away once they get it, but it clearly changes the equation.
As you know, Kim Jong-un has kind of sold his people a narrative that the U.S. wants to destroy his regime and his country. Is there any truth to that narrative?
There is no truth to the narrative that we want to destroy their country. There probably is some truth to the narrative that the United States has never really accepted the existence of North Korea, and particularly its regime, for obvious reasons, that this is a totalitarian government that commits widespread human rights abuses. So, you know, there is some logic to what they're saying, but certainly not to the extent that we want to destroy their country if we get a chance.
Safe to say, though, the United States would prefer to see one unified Korea that's democratic as opposed to two separate ones.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, if you're a North Korean, that would make you fairly nervous.
Joel Witt, former U.S. negotiator with North Korea, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
North Korea's nuclear ambitions are a delicate subject, maybe not as delicate, though, as what we're going to talk about next. Fair warning, the next few minutes are all about bodily functions. You see, in Thailand, there's a big debate over toilets. Western-style toilets, the kind you sit on, are growing in popularity, but many Thais are skeptical. They prefer using traditional squat toilets. So we sent the world's Patrick Nguyen out and about in Bangkok to find out why some think squatting is superior.
Does your toilet sound like this? Well, globally speaking, you are in the minority. In much of the world, a toilet sounds more like this. This is the rhythmic splashing of a squat toilet, common across Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. To flush a squat toilet, you typically just toss buckets of water into a hole. Because that's really what a squat toilet is, a hole in the floor, ideally connected to a sewer line. Sit-down toilets are seen as a sign of progress. In some places in Asia, including China, officials have tried to increase the number of Western-style toilets. Now, if you're a Westerner, you may be thinking, good, surely everyone would prefer a modern commode over a hole in the floor. But that is not always true. That's Nakhon, a truck driver in Bangkok. Like a lot of people here, he says squatting is just more natural. Let's back up a bit and explain exactly how people use squat toilets. I'm at a gas station in Bangkok in front of your typical squat toilet. And if you've never seen one, just picture a toilet bowl built into the ground. No seat, just the bowl. And then you just squat over it. And to my right, there's a little tile basin full of clean water. And this is important because you use a little ladle to splash that water onto yourself and get clean. There is no tissue. And then when you're finished, you just dump more water on top to flush everything down. And that's it. That's a SWAT toilet. In Thailand, health officials are on a mission to install sit-down toilets in half the country's homes and almost all of its public restrooms. But they're struggling to persuade everyone to go along, in part because lots of people say squatting is superior. And you know what? They might be onto something.
The squat method is good for poo more than sit on the chair.
That's Dr. Yutana. He's a gastroenterologist at Bangkok's Bomrungrad Hospital, one of the best in Southeast Asia. The doctor says that as long as your knees can take it, yes, squatting is better. Everyone has a muscle back there called the puborectalis. It controls when you go and when you're holding it in. When you're sitting down on a toilet seat, the doctor says, this muscle cannot fully relax.
If you do squat, this muscle will relax so the poo can come out easily. But if you just sit down on the chair, you don't have much pressure on the tummy.
So it seems like squatting puts your intestines in a nice, neat line.
That's true.
It's not that commodes are uncommon in Asia. In Thailand, middle-class homes generally do have sit-down toilets. After all, you can buy one here for only about $100. But many people from the countryside or poor neighborhoods, they still don't see what's so great about these toilets from the West. And those are the people I'm keen to meet. I'm headed into a very working-class neighborhood in Bangkok where most people do use the squat technique. And I'm going to try and get total strangers to open up about their toilet preferences. It doesn't take long before I meet some unrepentant squatters. Sit-down toilets are weird, says Sutep. He's a 60-year-old day laborer. Whether you've got a big butt or a small butt, he says, it's gonna touch the seat. Ugh. And sometimes he says it feels like his butt will get stuck. But this toilet issue, it's about more than just comfort. Sutep says that a toilet can actually reveal your place in society. Here, in the slums, he says, we have no time to spare. We gotta rush back to work. So, we squat. Sit-down toilets are for rich people, he says. They're like, oh, hey, I'm chilling out, reading the paper on the toilet. No worries for me. A small crowd forms, and I notice everyone nodding along. Everyone except one woman, rolling her eyes. She says, my name is Sui. I'm 57. I've worked hard all my life. And my knees hurt. Okay, I say. So what's your toilet preference? Commodes are the best, she says. You can sit down. You can relax. Turning to Sutep, she says, look, if you're too large or too old, you don't have a choice. You need a commode. Now, the ideal scenario, she says, having both toilet styles at your disposal. And once again, the crowd nods in approval. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Colombian government and FARC rebels sign a peace accord. One Colombian American took to Twitter to react.
I wrote these tweets. That's what I did. I meant to just post one tweet.
Yeah.
I was like, this is great.
One tweet turned into 20 and a very personal family story. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It has been the longest-running armed conflict in the Western Hemisphere, and finally it seems to be coming to an end. The conflict is between Colombia's government and the rebel group known as the FARC. The parties announced a deal last night that would halt the five-decade-long struggle. For The World's Isis Madrid, this is all very personal. Her family has deep roots in Colombia. Isis is one of our social media journalists, so when she heard the news about the deal, she took to Twitter. Her series of tweets began with a description of her parents.
They're both from Antioquia, both my parents. My dad and his family are from El Quindío, which is the famous coffee-growing region. Mm. And it's the same area that the FARC and all those leftist rebel groups kind of started up because it's very indigenous. And then my mom is from the countryside outside Medellín.
What was their worldview?
So it was the 60s. My parents were born in the late 40s, so they're hippies. They named me Isis. After the Egyptian goddess of fertility, right, and the moon and womanhood. They're pretty liberal, which is not always the norm in Colombia. And they grew up during a time that was, it's called La Violencia, in the 40s and 50s, which is when the conservatives and the liberals in Colombia were at war, and thousands of people were dying all over the country. And that is the environment that a lot of the people who created the FARC and other rebel groups grew up in.
And your relatives actually went to school with the children of the Colombian man who founded the movement known as the FARC, Manuel Tiro Fijo Marulanda. What kind of stories did you hear about Tiro Fijo from your family?
Of course, this is all folklore, so I can't fact check it, even though I wish I could. But my dad has told me that people would say that Tiro Fijo, once his son got in trouble at school, so the teacher disciplined him. The kid went home, told Tiro Fijo what happened. Tiro Fijo went and found the teacher at the local town bar and, like, punched him in the face, maybe more. The story varies from person to person.
Yeah, but these are the things of legend, aren't they?
Yeah, the word on the street was that he was a pretty violent man from the beginning, before the FARC.
Yeah, what does Tiro Fijo mean?
Tiro Fijo means sure shot. So anything he points a gun at, he'll hit it.
Do you think your relatives saw the FARC as something that was saving them or something dangerous?
I don't know about my parents, but the generation that my parents belong to, it's kind of like Pablo Escobar. He's like, you know, the Robin Hood for the people, the common people. You know, the Castros in Cuba and the FARC were kind of allies at a certain point. In the beginning, it was all about communism, sharing the wealth, equality, gender equality in theory. So they were all, you know, idealistic. So I think at the very beginning, I'm sure people thought that this was a good thing.
But as time went on, I gather your relatives started to see things differently. What do you think? What did they witness, do you think, that changed their minds?
You know, the FARC quickly became corrupt. They became involved in drug dealing and cocaine manufacturing and growing. And yeah, that became kind of the bread and butter of how the FARC was getting its money. And there were kidnappings.
Yeah, tell us about your uncle.
My uncle, he's an amazing person. He's an activist, an immigration lawyer. He was, you know, fighting for the little people in Medellin and fighting against corruption in the 80s. And a meeting he was at got bombed, and my uncle was getting threats and phone calls. And he fled to Connecticut and moved in with me and my mom and dad the week I was born. So he kind of fled that craziness and ended up here and ended up being the one that was rocking me to sleep when I was crying every night as a newborn.
And your great aunt, not so lucky.
My great aunt, she was kidnapped by a rebel group, and they made her call her kids and relatives for ransom money. And she grabbed the phone and said, "Don't pay these people. It's not worth it. I'll die for this." They tied her to a tree in the middle of the courtyard of her home, and they just left her there to brave the elements, and she died.
That must have been shocking for your family.
Yeah, it was not easy.
Isis, you were born in the U.S., made your first trip to Colombia when you were 6 years old in the 90s with your mom, and you went back to her childhood home. And a few of your tweets are about something that happened on that trip. Tell us about that.
It was a beautiful trip. We went all around the country visiting family. And my mom took me on a bus trip to the town that she was born in. And on the way there, the bus got pulled over by a group of armed men. And I was scared. You know, my mom tells me I was shaking. But yeah, they were looking for a man. They were tipped off that he was going to be on this bus, and he wasn't, but they pulled everyone off the side of the road to kind of search everyone and check IDs, and there were just huge men with giant rifles standing there, like, pointing them at us. And my mom was just trying to keep me calm, and she was like, "It's fine, don't worry, it's going to be okay, you know, they're just looking for a guy, and, you know, we'll just get back on the bus and we'll be fine." And all the women around us were like, "Oh no, hasta aquí llegamos, this is the end." So it was crazy. And yeah, my mom sang me a little song to keep me happy. Caminando, caminando, la guerrilla es un amor.
And what does that translate as?
Step by step, the guerrilla is love.
What is it like for you thinking about this stuff?
Oh, it's tough.
I mean, like, do you talk about that incident on the bus with your mother and the fact that, gosh, at the age of six, you might have witnessed an execution in the streets?
Yeah, we talk about it sometimes, and it's just amazing how strong my parents are.
Yeah.
And my whole family. They lived through all of this and brought me here. And I got to have such a privileged life.
You want to take a breath?
Yeah.
So ISIS today, a step toward peace. I'm just curious to know about your parents and the idealism that they once had and how they reconcile it with all the violence and everything that came to pass in the last few decades.
Yeah, I think they still believe in those ideals. The little revolutionary is still alive in them. And, you know, they kind of raised me to fight the system and fight for equality and speak up. And I'm kind of a hardcore feminist because of them. My mom's a social worker. My dad, he cares a lot about saving the environment, and he loves poetry, and it didn't kill it in them. It's still in there. Yeah.
When you heard the news about this seemingly big step toward peace in Colombia, what did you do? Did you call your parents?
I wrote these tweets. That's what I did. I meant to just post one tweet.
Yeah.
I was like, this is great. It
took off, became
and
20 tweets.
Yeah, all of a sudden I found myself with like a 2,300 character count. So, yeah. I just couldn't stop writing. It brought out all this emotion in me that I didn't know I had. And I'm just curious about what's going to happen next. You know, obviously this isn't the end of the problems that Colombia has.
Well, I really appreciate your talking about it. I know it's not easy. The World's ISIS Madrid, thank you very much for sharing these thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
If you want to read ISIS's tweets about Colombia, we've got them on our own Twitter feed. We are at PRI The World. In Brazil, the afterglow of the Olympics, if we can call it that, officially ended today as politics took center stage. The country's Senate opened the impeachment trial of suspended President Dilma Rousseff. I use the word suspended instead of former president. That's because Dilma Rousseff refused to resign to make the point that she was ousted illegally. The World's Will Carlos is based in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. So remind us what Dilma Rousseff is charged with, Will.
So Dilma Rousseff is charged with essentially kind of playing some financial shenanigans with the budget, moving money around in order to make the budget look better than it actually was, look in a better situation, basically borrowing money from one part of the government and sort of plugging it into another part in the run-up to her re-election in 2014. That's the official reason as to why she's being impeached.
And is that illegal, what she did?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, it certainly technically seems to be illegal, but her argument is and has been, well, that she's not by any means the first president to have done this, that her predecessors did it. She did do it to a greater extent, but her point is, look, I mean, lots of people did this before me and didn't get impeached for it. So it's largely seen as a kind of a proxy for lots of other good reasons to get rid of her.
And aside from self-preservation, why does she deny she did anything wrong?
Well, it is mainly self-preservation, but it's also sort of, I mean, she's a former guerrilla. She's got a real sense of pride and a real sense of what's right and wrong. And she sees what's happened to her as a coup that has been organized by the right wing in Brazil to get rid of a democratically elected president because they can't win elections. I mean, the PT, her party, has been in power for 13 years. They've won the last three elections. And so she sees this as sort of a way of usurping her legitimate power and trying to sort of put it in the hands of a minority that can't get themselves elected.
How long is this impeachment trial going to last? And will Dilma Rousseff herself take the stand?
Not much longer is the answer to that. It seems to have been dragging on forever and ever, but it is definitely in its final phases now. Dilma will take the stand. She takes the stand for the first time, it should be said, to defend herself. I think it's only for 30 minutes or something on Monday morning. Goodness only knows what she's going to say. I imagine it'll be much of what she's said in the public in terms of, you know, I've done nothing wrong and this is a coup. But yes, so she takes the stand. Then the vote is set to begin, I believe, at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, although they keep moving it around, and it's expected to last sort of long into the night, if not into Wednesday morning. I suspect we'll have a decision one way or another by the time people start getting up on the East Coast on Wednesday morning, and we'll probably have a new president in Brazil by then.
A new president. So the outcome is fairly predictable at this point, you think?
It really is. I mean, there are 81 senators in total. Two-thirds of them, that's 54, need to vote to oust her. A poll published by O Globo, which is the big newspaper here in Rio, on Thursday showed that 51 senators are already committed to voting to dismiss Dilma. So we're looking at, you know, only three more. There have been past votes on this sort of along the way where she has been sort of pretty comprehensively voted out. I don't think many people are expecting a big change in scenario at this point. Most people think she's done come Wednesday.
So, Will, as you go about Rio, what is the mood as people shift from the spectacle of the Olympics to the spectacle of impeachment proceeding?
Honestly, I think your average person on the street tuned out of this political saga a long time ago. People talk about the importance of the corruption scandal. They talk about the importance of the legal investigation that's going in against the bad people that corrupted Brazil over the last few years. But they don't talk much about the sort of machinations in Brasilia. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of Brazilians think that Dilma's already been impeached, frankly. Wow. And so, I mean, literally, it's been such a long, convoluted process. I was talking to an expert earlier on today who said that even the polling shows that people, the analogy he used, he said, look, if politics in Brasilia, the capital, were a telenovela, there is a lot of signals that people switched over to a different telenovela prior to the Olympics and started watching something else. And that's interesting. I mean, whether that changes in the next few days as this comes back into the headlines, we'll see. But because it's such a sort of a foregone conclusion that she's out, I think people largely have switched off.
The World's Will Carlos speaking with us from Rio. Thank you, Will.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up after the break, we'll have an update on the situation in central Italy after a devastating earthquake. But I wanted to take a moment to talk about one of the towns hit hardest, Amatrice. It's home to a few thousand people, but it has an outsized place in Italian cuisine thanks to one dish, pasta all'amatriciana. It's so important to the town that there's an annual festival devoted to it. But because of the earthquake, the festival's been canceled this year. Pasta all'amatriciana is super simple. Here's Italian-American chef Lidia Bastianich describing it on The World a while back.
The original amatriciana, even before the tomatoes came from the New World, was a pasta dish made out of fresh pasta. The sauce was basically guanciale, which is the cured cheek of the pork, pecorino cheese, which these pastori, these herders that would go up in the hills with their sheep, this is what they would do. Would take a little fire, put a little bit of the guanciale from the pig that they had in their little sack, put the water to cook for the pasta, threw in the pasta, a little bit of wine in the guanciale just to make the sauce, and then added the pecorino cheese, again, from the sheep. So that was the traditional. Then in the 1500s, I gather, the tomatoes came, and that still is the original.
It sounds great because it is great. And Bastianich says there is no better place to taste it than in Amatrice.
I love it in bianco, which is like a carbonara.
So without the tomatoes.
Without the tomatoes, I like amatrice in bianco l'amatriciana, but in Rome, more often than not, you find it now traditional red sauce. And it's only the jowl and the tomatoes, and I guess they put a little bit of wine in there, and the pasta, and it's delicious.
With much of amatrice now in ruins, some 700 restaurants across Italy say they'll add pasta all'amatriciana to their menus. That's after a graphic designer in Rome, Paolo Campana, posted the idea on Facebook. I've got requests from all over Italy and also from abroad, Campana told the French news agency. Even chefs who have never cooked it before are going to try it. In Rome, restaurants are donating €2 from each plate of amatriciana they sell to earthquake relief efforts. Italians love arguing about what ingredients should and should not go into the dish. I will add my own note. Use the pasta known as bucatini, spaghetti-length tubes. It's really how it ought to be. And when you eat, spare a thought for the good people in Amatrice. Remembering jazz great Bobby Hutcherson, that's ahead here on The World. Some natural disasters get a lot of attention, others don't. For example, did you know that monsoon flooding in India has affected over 1 million people? Yep, more on that in a few minutes. First, though, here's a quick update on a natural disaster that has gotten attention, the earthquake in central Italy. At least 241 people are now confirmed dead, and three medieval towns have been reduced to rubble. Survivors like Silvano Parla says this quake was especially terrifying. I've lived through many earthquakes over the years, Parla says, but one like this one, never. It was long and ugly. Rescue crews continue to search the rubble for people who may be trapped and alive. But the window for hopeful outcomes is quickly closing. Giovanni Coviello is a regional commander for Italy's Forest Rangers.
I think that they can resist for 12 or 15 hours more. But at the end of this afternoon, we declare to stop their search.
Until then, Coviello says his crews will search. They're even using their bare hands to move rubble when necessary. Last night, that kind of perseverance paid off. That was the moment rescuers pulled a young girl alive from the rubble, a rare moment of good news in an otherwise difficult night. Rescuers and residents alike are also wary of aftershocks. Another smallish one shook the town of Amatrice this morning. Werner Marzocchi is a chief scientist at Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology. He's concerned there could be another big quake in the region.
Earthquakes tend to occur in cluster in space and time. This means that after a large earthquake like this one, it is more likely to have other large earthquake not very far from it.
Italy's not the only place where rescue operations are ongoing. In Louisiana, FEMA trailers will be popping up again for people who've been flooded out of their homes. Temporary shelters are also appearing in parts of India. The annual monsoons have flooded massive areas of land there. Rivers have burst their banks, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate their homes. Bidisha Pillay is with Save the Children in New Delhi. She says deadly floods are not a new phenomenon.
It has become an annual affair now, unfortunately, in India, Marco. This year, you know, close to 1 million children, I think, have been affected in particular by these floods. They've been forced to leave their homes. They've been forced to leave their belongings and move to higher embankments where, you know, there is hardly any place for people to live decently. There is no access to clean drinking water or toilets. Schools have been turned into temporary relief camps, but that's just not enough to accommodate the millions of people who've had to leave their homes.
It sounds really terrible. What are you hearing about the aid operations from the field?
So we have a presence in three of the states which have been affected this year. That's Assam, Bihar, and Uttar Pradesh. We've deployed our teams to some of the worst affected states. We have immediately started distribution of, you know, tarpaulin, floor mats, solar lamps, hygiene kits, which includes mosquito nets and soap and a bucket. We're also distributing education kits for children because one of the things we find is that schooling and children's education gets majorly disrupted. We've also set up some child-friendly spaces because we find either parents are, children are separated from their parents, but also sometimes parents are so busy going about looking for food, trying to get basic needs met that they have to leave their children behind in a safe space. And we've set up about 10 of these centers. These are usually spaces which not only have the basic necessities, you know, to take care of the health needs, but they're also equipped with games, etc. So, you know, we can restore some semblance of normalcy to these children in what is otherwise a very, very difficult situation.
You know, Bidisha, I was struck by something your director at Save the Children in India was quoted as saying. Nowadays, he said, floods are seen as a chronic problem and are viewed differently from other emergencies, so they often no longer attract adequate attention from either the media or donors. Let me ask you, what do you think about that? Are floods just so predictable that they are not assigned kind of the same urgency as other disasters?
I would agree with that. We've reached a point, I think, where both drought and floods, which are occurring essentially due to climate change, have become sort of an annual affair in India. Yet we are not adequately prepared to respond to them. And at the same time, there seems to be a fatigue, you know, in the minds of common everyday people, in media, fatigue in the minds of donors on responding to something like this. An earthquake, for example, in Nepal, which is a terrible thing, somehow, because it's not occurring on an annual basis, tends to capture the imagination of the public, you know, far better than the floods, which is a real pity.
So in the longer term, what do you think could prove to be better solutions that might help families and children survive floods?
You know, we've got to look at how we can sort of help people have alternative livelihood options that they could get back to when they're affected. Looking at creating permanent housing structures on higher grounds or higher embankments rather than just on the banks of rivers. Having better early warning systems for disasters and tools so we can prepare better. perhaps more warehouses, you know, where you can stockpile medicines and drugs and food and basic necessities, which will, you know, not take that much time to respond to families who've been affected or displaced by disasters.
Do you have any family yourself in any of the states that are affected who've had to evacuate?
Well, not myself, but we have loads of people in our office who come from Uttar Pradesh or Bihar. The tragedy is that while we are able to respond as an organization, sometimes they're not able to respond on an immediate family basis because families are trapped and they find it hard to get out.
Well, strength to you all. Bidisha Pillay for Save the Children in India. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
While I was on vacation, some sad news. The death of a great jazz player, Bobby Hutcherson, best known for his work on the vibraphone. A sound so chill and groovy it became a fixture within the lively acid jazz scene in London in the 1990s.
Well, it's the lazy days, what the lazy days. I'm sitting back in my lounge chair, stone cold maxing. Thinking about the next MC, I'm gonna wax in concert. Going berserk, but not today.
That's the London acid jazz collective Us Three in 1993, sampling Bobby Hutcherson's track, Going Down South. I want to close out the show today by paying homage to Hutcherson. He was a massively creative soul. But I also want to tip the hat to Us Three, as well as other acid jazz players, because if they had not sampled artists like Bobby Hutcherson, a lot of us wouldn't know about him. Thanks to the Us Three recording Hand on the Torch, a younger generation dug up Hutcherson's original tracks from Blue Note Records. And then they heard the full brilliance of Hutcherson's improvisations. Late Bobby Hutcherson hitting the vibes there as only he knew how. He died last week at the age of 75. And that is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.